What does it really take to run a $38 billion state agency when demands far exceed capacity, budgets shift without warning, and every decision involves impossible trade-offs? Today, we're pulling back the curtain on state leadership with someone who managed 18,000 staff while navigating COVID-19, a historic Medicaid expansion, and a behavioral health crisis all at the same time. I'm Lisa Berry, and this is The Policy Stack, where we explore how health policy actually gets implemented in the real world. I'm really excited to welcome you to this inaugural episode of The Policy Stack podcast. Our guest today is Cody Kinsley, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services for North Carolina. And I'm excited to welcome you here today, Cody.
It's great to be here. Inaugural, no less. I'm honored.
Inaugural. Exactly. So for the Policy Stack podcast, we are trying to sort of explore how health policy actually gets implemented in the real world. And I feel like you are a wonderful, almost perfect guest to help our audience understand the real world implementation of policy, what actually happens, you know, pulling back the curtain on that state leadership and managing tremendous capacity constraints and also getting some incredible things done. So I'd love to just start with you doing a brief intro for the audience from your background, how you got here, and what you sort of what you did in your time in North Carolina.
Sure. Well, first, Lisa, let me just applaud you for diving into where the rubber meets the road. I mean, you know, I think that that's where the most interesting policy work is, and it was one of the things that I learned early in my career. You know, one of my first jobs in government was working at the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT. This was in the ambitious time when meaningful use and EHR adoption and HIE and everything was rolling out of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And there was this vision of trying to connect and streamline, and still a lot more work to do there. But I saw very quickly in that experience that the difference between the vision of what could be done and what happens was really made up by the clever implementation of the work happening on the ground, whether it was the folks creating the tech systems to help support people, the on-the-ground programs across, you know, 50 different states and even more territories. And so getting that implementation right is what really was intoxicating to me. You know, give me the vision and we're going to run after it. And that's been the guiding light through most of my career. I worked at the federal government for about a decade. My kind of final stop there was as the Assistant Secretary for Management of the U.S. Treasury. So a big ops job. Also did some policy work at the White House and, as I mentioned, HHS. And then came home to North Carolina, where I'm from. I joined as the in charge of the behavioral health work here. That was a full circle moment for me in my career. I had started out working there, and then midway through COVID, took on the role of secretary, ran our operations work for COVID, you know, where the rubber met the road. I mean, it made the difference. Get shots in arms efficiently and effectively. Could you, or as we like to say, fast and fair, could you, you know, get treatment out? How could you thread together the operational work, actually getting the stuff to people, the policies so they could make sense to folks, and actually getting the communications out so people knew what to do? I mean, threading all that together made the difference. But took over as secretary at the end of 2021 and, you know, had an amazing little over 3 years. We expanded Medicaid in North Carolina, adding now 657,000 people to the rolls, nearly 600,000 in year one alone. Big operational challenges there. We had 40% of people going through without ever having to talk to a person. We increased the behavioral health access to our system by $835 million, really redesigning care. We launched the country's first investment in food with using Medicaid dollars as part of our Healthy Opportunities pilot. And then we did a big policy effort to relieve medical debt, $4 billion for 2 million North Carolinians. So amazing work, an amazing team, and an amazing moment for North Carolina.
Yeah, that's incredible. So, looking at your background, we talked about this as well, but I've also read some of the things you've written about your experience. You personally grew up without health insurance, but then you were also the person who was really responsible for moving, and increasing, dramatically increasing access to health insurance for North Carolinians. How did that background, how did your personal experience drive your thinking and your ability to allocate resources towards that? I know it was a moment in time, but I'd love to hear sort of how the personal experience you had growing up. I grew up on Medicaid, Medi-Cal as well. So just would love to, know how that had shaped your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that government, I'll tell you a couple stories. So one, actually hone in on COVID, right? Like remember the time when we were telling everybody that, testing was free, and you should go get tested, like get tested whenever you don't feel well, testing is available. And we were also telling people, don't go to the emergency room. Like the last place you want to be, we don't want you to spread the disease. If you do have COVID, like there's nothing they're going to really be able to do for you there. Well, if I think coming from the perspective of having grown up without health insurance, and still at a time in North Carolina when we had over 1 million people without health insurance because we had not yet expanded Medicaid yet, it's an important reminder that A, like the first reaction of anybody who has grown up uninsured or is uninsured is that nothing in the health system is free. Like, what are you talking about with regard to testing being free? I don't believe it, right? So how do you pierce through that very hard-learned experience? You have to use trusted messengers. You have to get the communications right. You have to make it available. You have to, make the process easy. I mean, all the things to try to overcome that barrier. Second, you're telling a group of people where the only place they go for healthcare is the emergency room, not to go there. So the one thing you understand. And so lessons like that are important. And it's why, whenever you have a team, and this word seems to be a bad word right now, which I really hate, which is like you need a diverse team. You need a group of people with a lot of different experiences who have come from a lot. And look, I mean, political experiences, policy experiences, different backgrounds. I mean, I wanted people from all over, different places to make sure that they could shape policy and programs that could meet everybody where they are. And if they weren't the person, then they knew who to call. And that is what's really important about building kind of a dynamic team with a lot of different perspectives. So that's like a good story. I will tell you a very honest bad story, which is, we were rolling out Medicaid managed care, and one of our programs that we were rolling out was called Tailored Plans, and this was for individuals, and this it is an operation now. This is for individuals with complex mental illness or intellectual developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries. Very small population of people, but again, very tailored Medicaid managed care portfolio. And we're being joined by my dog. And so, anywho, you could choose. You could be in that plan based off those diagnoses, et cetera, or you could choose to be in the standard plan. And we had a form that we called the Raise Your Hand form. And at some point in the process, we were having a community meeting, and someone raised their hand and said, "This is a really nice raise your middle class hand form."
Wow. That's
And
great.
it was a V8 moment, right? Like where people kind of like made clear that our policy thinkers and the folks that were working behind the scenes did not have the life experience of the people that we were serving. Now, that was why we were going to the community meeting. That's why we were sharing with them the form. I mean, we're not going to get everything right out of the gate. Mistakes are going to happen. But again, it's an important reason why I think our lived experiences and bringing that part of ourselves into this work is so important. But yeah, as we kind of ventured into our fight on Medicaid expansion, which, I have to say, like, first and foremost, Governor Roy Cooper, leader on this from day one, never let go, spent his entire time as governor trying to get this done and build a coalition when nobody else could. It got to the point where, like, I struggled to find anyone in North Carolina that was against this. It was just about trying to,
Amazing.
like, get the pieces together to actually do it. But
Huge part of
often,
policy change is bringing people along with you, right? Just
totally.
getting them excited. It takes years. It takes huge sort of cross-sector, massive amounts of engagement. That is like the advocacy work that is truly a beast in terms of getting people to come along with you, especially when there are so many differing ideas about it.
it's also what makes it durable, right? I mean, totally. You know, it's like go fast, go alone, go far, go together, right?
Right.
And so if you want to bring something that is really durable, then you've got to work hard with people to get it done.
That's right. That's right. So that's I definitely appreciate those examples because it shows you where you, even with all, you know, best efforts, you're going to miss something. You're going to, people are going to say, that's actually not how it works, right? In reality, this doesn't work for me for X, Y, and Z reason, or for this community for X, Y, and Z reason, right? It's just the reality of implementing policy. You have this great idea on paper, and then when it meets reality, rubber meets the road, you're like, okay, maybe not. One of the big things you talked about before, you've spoken about your experiences around capacity. And when I think about, imagine what it would be like to run a state agency, I imagine just incredible capacity challenges. You know, you have a limited amount of money and you have an unlimited amount of things that need to be done. You know, I'd love for you to take us back to those extremely bad old days of the height of the COVID pandemic when you are managing COVID response, but you have, you know, latent and worsening behavioral health problems with missing funding. You have Medicaid expansion happening. You have all kinds of other issues trying to modernize data systems, right? All of those different things. You know, how do you practically deal with that when you're at the head of this agency? The money is limited, the problems are unlimited, and there's huge opportunity as well.
Yeah. So, you know, whenever we, I have a firm belief that whenever we get into the time machine here and go back into COVID land, it's important that we ground ourselves in the reality that we were all learning a lot every day. That there was a lot of unknowns, right? What made this a novel disease was that it was new. That's what novel means. And it was new to our immune systems. It was new to our knowledge base as far as how it behaved. There was a time when we were all washing our bananas. And we
bleaching our boxes or whatever.
Exactly, right? And you know, we just didn't know. And we were moving as fast as we could and adapting as fast as we could. So that was a big variable that made it a very challenging environment. But actually, you know, there were also some really interesting bright spots here, right? We stood up a vaccine registry system in 6 weeks. We in North Carolina built our own. We were the first in the country to say that race and ethnicity data was not optional. We were able to build pipelines through, you know, APIs to our hospitals. So that way, as our primary vaccinators, they could send us that data automated and minimize the fat fingering and the duplicative entry and speed it up. That would have not been done had we used another product. I don't know of a technology system that was built so fast in my time in service. And that was for a lot of reasons. That was one, because we had money dedicated to the process. We had focus, the ability to prioritize, the ability to say no to other things, which is, it's a gift. That's a gift in government. You rarely get to say no. And with that money and that mandate, then we were able to deliver. I mean, it really showcased just how creative and fast. We also had like amazing procurement flexibilities. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't have to go out. And like, as we think about how do we reimagine government and make it work better for people, like, you know, that's the kind of stuff I'm in love with. Like, how can we think about, you know, still maintaining fair and transparent processes, but how can we speed it up? Whether it's the procurement process or the human capital process, there's a number of things that, you know, our own processes, which again, I understand the intent for which they were designed, but I don't know if they meet the moment of where we are today.
Right.
And so I think there are a lot of opportunities. Now, more to your question, like you're right, like, outside of COVID times, like in normal times, like I had a staff of 18,000, a department of $38 billion, and we were still not resourced to meet the need. I also had a vacancy rate at one point of 25%.
Wow.
Like, and so it was really hard, you know, when you're serving 11.6 million people to like meet everybody's priorities. And again, we're often and rarely able to say no on something. And I could drill into a whole bunch of examples. I think part of being a leader in these roles are obviously one, like being, you know, able to provide a prioritization framework for your team to get everybody going in the same direction, to, as a leader, understand, like, if I make progress on this, that will ease up on these things, to find those kind of clever process improvement, kind of Kaizen moments for people who do Lean Six Sigma stuff, where you can try to improve something, you know, to build credibility of your abilities as an operator with your legislative partners. So that way, every time you've made progress, they hopefully give you a little bit more money. I always wanted to be a good investment for them. I think that's why we got our behavioral health dollars from them. But it is really hard. And I would say to, like, the vendor community out there, like, you know, the number of times people would come into my office with a solution in search of a problem, like, no, don't do that. Right. But if you can actually solve my problem, like, I'll pay you anything. And you know, really understanding the nuances of how these problems work in government is important. But that's where leadership comes in place, and experience, right? I was a good operator. Like, during COVID, we redid our Medicaid eligibility system while we were not having to redetermine people, which enabled us to be prepared for Medicaid expansion. And I had that thought because I had failed at implementing large systems earlier in my career and remembered the trauma of those moments. And that gave me the archetype to then see, oh, I can see what we're about to do, and we're not going to fail this time. And so here's our opportunity. Let's lean in now. And I think that experience is what made us so prepared operationally.
So let's get specific about that, because I understand what that means, but not everybody might get sort of the context there, which is that, you know, during COVID, there were these flexibilities around Medicaid eligibility redetermination. There was a period of time where, you know, states and insurers and others wouldn't kick people off of insurance for the eligibility reasons they might otherwise churn, like, you know, like their income increasing or whatever else might determine eligibility. And so during that time where you didn't have to do redetermination every year, you took, or however, whatever the time frame was at the time, you took that downtime to rebuild the eligibility system. Is that right?
That's right. So I have to look this up. Maybe we can look it up really quick, but I'm pretty sure it was while President Trump was in office in his first term, Congress passed a law that essentially extended people on the Medicaid program across the country for as long as the public health emergency was in place.
That's right.
And two things. One, we knew that at some point we would need to redetermine all those people, right? So we had a swell in eligibility because we weren't, North Carolina does eligibility annually. So for several years, people were just rolling forward. And people had lost their jobs. There was a lot of fluctuations. We had a lot of reason why people were coming on to Medicaid initially. So we had this kind of swell of participants. And so we knew we were going to have to redetermine everybody. And we knew we were going to have a big kind of backlog, if you will, right? Having a whole lot of people come through all at once and figure that out. And so we started to invest in new technologies, right? We started to use income data from third-party vendors. We changed the way our technology works so that way people did not have to necessarily go into an office. We updated our online portal tools so that people could do things more automated to clear out the number of spots in our offices so that when people needed to go in, we did retraining for staff. We also took advantage of a lot of policy flexibilities that Centers for Medicaid and Medicare then allowed us to use. Like, if someone had applied for SNAP recently, you know, food supports, and had provided their insurance, or I'm sorry, their income information through that process, then we could use that information instead. Right. But that's easier said than done, right? Like, these are very different technology systems that sit in very different places in government. And so getting the pipelines built for those things that actually talk to each other. But while I saw an opportunity for us to be ready for the wave of people that would need to be redetermined at the end of the public health emergency, I also saw the opportunity with Medicaid expansion to try to then get people on Medicaid efficiently. And so as we started to redetermine people, we saw that, wow, they're not eligible for Medicaid today. Like, pre-Medicaid expansion in North Carolina, like, you know, our income limits for some populations was 47%. We were not even at 100% of federal poverty. Like, we were very low. And so a whole lot of people were rolling off at the end of the public health emergency, but we knew that they would be able to come back on the other side of expansion. So we started tagging them and saving them in our system. Mm. So we rolled them off. So when we did launch expansion December 1st, 2023, those people just got a letter in the mail saying, welcome to Medicaid, you're fully covered, and they had to do nothing.
That's incredible. I think from my perspective, I think people having insurance coverage is incredibly, incredibly important. And the policies around Medicaid expansion obviously have been hotly debated recently. But from my perspective, minimizing churn, minimizing administrative burden, and making sure people can get on coverage, and also not wasting all of the effort across different state agencies. Again, if you've determined someone's eligible for SNAP, like, pretty sure they meet the income limits to be eligible for your Medicaid expansion program. And the only reason you would, you know, make that difficult is if you didn't want them to be covered. And, you know, we know that these programs are successful when you see the outcomes over time, but you've got to have continuous coverage to make that happen. And it sounds like you all put in a bunch of things, a bunch of processes in your eligibility and your redetermination process to make that easier over time and less burdensome.
We did. And I will, you know, I will be an equal opportunist when it comes to finding ways to improve things. So I pick on everybody equally. Well, maybe not equally, but I will pick on everybody. I will say that the current regulatory regime around eligibility for Medicaid also is really scared of conflict of interest. So like we've got like Medicaid managed care partners and I would say kind of like a guiding piece of the kind of the Affordable Care Act and other things was that in the laws that govern Medicaid managed care are like, we don't want like insert company here essentially helping you with eligibility because we're worried that they will self-deal and they will get you. But like, who do you connect with more often than anybody else if you're on Medicaid managed care? Is that company. Like they know right. Where you are, they know when you go to the doctor, like they can like get to you faster. And so a lot of our like processes and requirements in the Medicaid eligibility system right now are like extra steps to try to prevent that self-dealing and that conflict of interest. And I think we need to revisit that. Like we had a minor waiver during the public health emergency. Like we're now in an environment in this country and, you know, where if you had Medicaid managed care, employer sponsored coverage, healthcare.gov coverage, and Medicare Advantage, you could still be with one company through all four of those experiences in your life. And we know that when we give people the choice on which plan they want to be in, like only like 10% or less of people actually ever choose. Right. And so we introduce a whole lot of inefficiency into the system in the belief that that creates more fairness. And I think we do that in a lot of places. I think we do that in our procurement laws. I think we do that in our human capital laws. I think we do that in a lot of places. And I think we're about to do that with the work requirements. And so I think following the spirit of like really understanding where, and you said this at the top, like where the goals don't necessarily align to the outcome when implemented and how do we rethink that?
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk briefly about the behavioral health work you did before we go back to the Medicaid expansion. I don't want to miss that huge win around behavioral health investment in North Carolina. No, so as you noted, you secured something like $835 million for behavioral health in North Carolina, but you had basically no staff or minimal new staff. So you've got money, but then somehow they didn't give you the ability to bring on staff to actually implement that. So the policy and the law and the appropriation was done, but then you were like, okay, how do I actually do this? Like, talk about how you walked through that kind of a policymaker's nightmare. You got this big win and then they're like, and implement it with volunteers, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I felt a little that way. I mean, well, you know, first off, like I am forever grateful to the General Assembly, the moment that we were in, like the ability to get $835 million to invest in behavioral health, of which $260 million was recurring annual dollars. We used those dollars to raise our Medicaid rates for behavioral health for the first time in a decade. We put some of our services well above Medicare rates, recognizing that we didn't really have a bed shortage problem. We had a rate problem. And so being able to like pay for what you want was such a meaningful difference and an important investment in the system. But we also, you know, had had a lot of people without care for a long time, and so we needed to kind of jumpstart the system and provide, you know, some capacity building dollars for, you know, new programs and new beds and new types of programs that did collaborative care and all this other stuff. And so, you know, yes, you're right. Like, the General Assembly did give us $835 million to do it, and exactly two staff.
Nice.
And so, you know, we had to reprioritize, right? We had to say, okay, we're going to put some of these things that we really want to do on the way, way, way back burner. The most important thing you can do as a leader, as I alluded to earlier, is tell your team no. That is very hard for people sometimes, but like, I really enjoy doing it. Like, that sounds fun. No, we are not going to do that. We're going to put that way, way back. And if anybody is upset about it, you can send them to me and I can point out all the things that we can do, because we're not doing that right now. But we have to do all those things, because I knew if we built out, you know, new capacity in communities, new satellite dosing systems for our substance use disorder programs, new community mental health beds, new mental health services, new technology platforms that allowed us to track where people were when they were ED boarding and moving them into the right place. Like, if we could do all those things, then I wouldn't need to spend as much time, money, and effort on a lot of the other things that we had been doing in our legacy system. And so I was buying my way out of that other work by doing that and reprioritizing the team to do it. And so that sort of implementation strategy really matters. And like, I'll be transparent, we also had to rely on contractors, right? We also had to like hire external partners. And some of that is like good, because you want an expert in X to do Y. And that is really good as well.
Nice. So, you know, obviously you just mentioned, right, what it was like to work with the General Assembly. North Carolina, famously a state that has been purple for a very long time, Republicans, Democrats going back and forth. And of course, getting done everything that you and the governor got done during your tenure was very much the result of working across the aisle. You know, talk about that a little bit. You know, you're working with Republican legislature, you're working with folks all across the state with different political backgrounds, and you're implementing policies that they historically oppose that have been controversial across the country and for sure across the state. You know, talk about that, managing up politically, managing down, managing across, getting people on your side. That is a skill that is in short supply across the country. And obviously, at least my opinion is that we won't get anywhere until we can truly work with people and with every political background and bring people along with us. So I'd love to know, you know, your insights from that experience, which obviously were honed over many years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always start with, you know, one, I've had the great fortune of, you know, being in DC, watching the policy environments there, watch how deals are made and how slow things work. And it rarely looks like compromise. It usually looks like kind of forced sacrificing and a variety of different things. And you know, one thing that I've enjoyed about being at the state level is that it is, you know, North Carolina has a volunteer legislature. You know, these are business owners and farmers and people who should and hopefully more often go back to their communities on a regular basis. It's a little bit because they don't have a whole lot of staff. It's like much more kind of the environment like forces a lot more collaboration. And so that that is a helpful thing. I mean, I think there are problems with the volunteer legislature in that there are a lot of people who can't run or can't be involved, and that's not great. But there is something nice about it not being professional, if you will. And also, you know, I was willing to put in the time and the effort to build the relationships, right? I always like to tell people, if you want to borrow my car, it may be good that you have a relationship with me before you ask for the keys.
Right.
Right. I think it's the same thing in policymaking, right? Like, if I want to try to do something meaningful, like, it would be good for me to have a really good relationship with my legislators before I go ask them for their vote. And so that takes a lot of time. That takes a lot of effort. And you've got obviously a staff of people that help with that. There's a lot of interaction, but we did a lot of big things together. We did our code work together. We did a lot of big bills. We did a lot of little bills on the way. And we, through each iterative step, had to build a lot of trust, right? We also got out into the community together, right? We did these mental health town halls all across the state Where whenever I would go into a community, I would bring the local delegation of state legislators together, the community folks, we would answer questions, we would talk about things together. So we were on the same team, right? That their team didn't care what party we were in or what area we were, like, to them, we represented the government or the government, and they wanted it to work, right? And we were seen as having to work together to do that. And, you know, and it's also about prioritizing, right? Like, there were things where I chose not to get, you know, worked up about because I had to maintain my chits for when I needed to move something. And that's in the same spirit of like leading a team and prioritizing the work. You got to prioritize your legislative strategy too. And that can be really hard. It can be really hard to explain to your team. It can be really hard to explain to advocates to be like, I really hear you. I'm with you. But I can't fight that battle right now because I've got to focus my energies on this and getting this done. That's where I see our ability to move.
You also have to have some blinders on, right? Don't get caught up in the PR, the noise, whatever's being floated in the media, because it is designed to provoke a response, and you have to stay focused on what's actually happening, what your actual goals are from a program, from a funding, from a legislative perspective, for sure.
Yeah, the role that I tried to play, and I think this is who I am, and I think I should have started here too. I mean, the other good fortune I had was, you know, I was a political appointee in the Obama administration as the Assistant Secretary for Management. I was held over by President Trump into his first administration. I was the only political holdover at the U.S. Treasury, and so I had the very good experience of all of a sudden being the one person with experience in their role who was not trusted by all the new people and having to earn their trust and having to earn it by my ability to get the job done and to serve the goals of the administration. And at some point, like, I left, I was done in that job, but I was really happy to, you know, and I remember at the time, like, to your point about keep blinders on and avoid the noise, like, there were a lot of people from my party who were screaming about things that I knew not to be true because I was actually on the inside. Like, the blame that was coming at us from the liberal folks was wrong. And and so, you know, I kind of saw it from both sides there. And it gave me a good dose of like, take a breath, right? Like, fault should be earned. And like, don't get caught up in the spin. And that's what I tried to do as a policymaker in North Carolina, was like, be the truth teller and be like, look, I'm going to stay out of all this political whatever, but here's what I'm going to tell you. Like, if you don't do this, this number of people will have this thing happen. Here's the math.
Yeah.
And just like, deal with the facts.
Right, exactly. It's never that simple. It's never that, that the platitudes don't necessarily reflect the reality, and you've got to understand what's actually happening on the ground. So I've actually spoken to, and we've spoken to on another podcast, the new Secretary of Health and Human Services in North Carolina, Secretary Sungbae, who's great. And, you know, he, for better or for worse, is going to be taking on a new requirement very, very soon to implement Medicaid work requirements. I'm sure you have thoughts about how to do that in a way that is most helpful and, you know, is going to result in people being legitimately covered under Medicaid. You know, any tips generally, not just to him, but for folks who are saying, okay, I've got to do this. This is the law. This is the requirement. How can I do this in the most efficient, effective way that, you know, ensures that people get legitimate coverage under Medicaid?
You know, I always like to start by saying that it is and has always been the interest of every health secretary or Medicaid director to, you know, accurately determine people's eligibility. Like, if they're eligible based off what the law says, we want them on. If they're ineligible, we do not want them on. Period. Right. Program integrity. That is always.
Why would you want to pay for coverage that isn't legitimate? You only have so much money.
That's right. And yeah. So, and what I think it's important for everybody to understand in this moment is that if I have new requirements that are implemented poorly, resulting in eligible people not being able to get on or stay on, then that's broken, right? Just as much as the other way, which is getting people on that are ineligible. And so I think that we are going to need, I think, starting good guidance from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. I think looking at a lot of the potential policy flexibilities that we used during COVID, I think we should think about that conflict of interest concept that I talked about earlier, as far as how we can partner with our Medicaid managed care partners and our providers to make it easier for people. Because,
right,
and whether it's in implementation or in policymaking writ large, like, let's go back to where we started around this idea of thinking about the people we're serving, right? So Medicaid expansion in North Carolina, which is what these work requirements will apply to, like, they are by definition people who are working, right? They are earning income, too much so that they could not be on Medicaid before we expanded, but not enough to be able to afford coverage through healthcare.gov. Like, they are, right, earning income. And so, but what is often in their lives, and I know this from my childhood, I know this from the friends that I have, like, they are working multiple jobs. They get their schedules once a week. Maybe those jobs go late into the night or all day during the day. They're balancing caregiving with their kids and with their elderly parents. Maybe they have unreliable transportation. They are taking buses. They have their route figured out. They live complex lives that are challenging and are not as easy as just popping in your car or calling in sick because you have covered leave. Like, they don't, a lot of people do not have those benefits.
We're using your fast internet and reliable computer, exactly, to fill out forms or access complex government websites.
That's exactly right. And so the net effect of this is, like, a lot of people do not have 4 hours to go sit in a lobby at a Department of Social Services. Because they may be able to get their Medicaid application finished, but they may lose their job in the process. Right. Like, you know, and so what we, like, North Carolina has always wanted, like, work. We believe that work is an important part of life. We think it can be a very important, like, we invested a lot in supportive employment for people with mental health issues. We think that it's community engagement, and we can talk about all that. And that's good. If this is about supporting people to have access to work and work is a meaningful part of life and a way to earn income and all these other things, great. Want to do that. What we don't want this to be is paperwork requirements.
Right.
Right. We don't want it, and for it to mess up. And so I think that is going to be the fusion of good technology, good implementation, but it is also going to be a lot of flexibilities from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare and a lot of creativity to think about what's really adding value in this process. How do we do this? How do we automate as much of this as possible? Because, you know, and I have said this before, like, we don't really have any good examples of where this has been done well when it comes to work requirements. But we have good examples of where unwinding went well. North Carolina, one of them, many other states as well, highly using ex parte data and all these other things. And we've got to push all those tools to the center of the table.
Yeah, and absolutely listen to and take, you know, feedback from the actual Medicaid members who are working and hopefully take into account, you know, the limitations that they are facing, because those outcomes will only be great if people are able to legitimately maintain coverage while they're working. Otherwise, you're just going to be reverting back to all the bad things that happen when a huge swath of your population is uninsured. And we know what that leads to. And that's pretty terrifying.
That's right. Well, and, like, I always like to remind people, like, nobody is, like, sitting on their couch, not working, getting money from Medicaid. Like, you know, like, that's not how Medicaid works. Like,
it's a strong myth. It's a strong myth that is hard for us to break. And, you know, there definitely are people who believe that. I certainly don't. You know, as somebody who grew up on Medicaid, Medi-Cal at the time, that was not the situation. Not even close.
No.
I mean, I was a kid, so I wasn't really earning any money, but I promise you, we were doing useful things. It's going to school. So you know, let's sort of end by talking a little bit more specifically about the policy stack. So for me, the policy stack is these, like, intersecting layers of federal, state, local policies that have to align for anything to actually work. And I think Medicaid expansion is a great example, because you had, you know, the ACA, you had all the rules around the ACA, you had the American Rescue Plan incentives, you had the state legislature, you know, authorizing and acting and funding and doing all this work. So, you know, how do you manage when the success really depends on these policies at every level kind of working together and there not being any big holes in the place? Like, what else on the policy stack comes to your mind when you're thinking about all the intersecting policies that, you know, had to work together to make this possible?
You know, the health and human services space is a terrific example of the policy stack. And we have a real life, you know, experience unfolding right now, right? The HR1 or OBA, the bill that the president signed into law on July 4th.
The appropriations bill, yep.
Yes, is for all intents and purposes, a healthcare bill. I mean, it's the most sweeping changes to healthcare, health and human services in the last 15 years since the ACA. And I would imagine most states will have to do some sort of session between now and early next year to deal with that, right? States that are going to need to appropriate dollars to implement work requirements or appropriate dollars to fill the gaps now presented in the SNAP budgets, to make other eligibility changes, to modify things to be in legal alignment with the federal government. Like, states will not be able to do, like, they've got now federal law guiding them on what to do, but they won't not be able to do it until additional policy decisions are made at the state level. And in North Carolina, we do eligibility in all 100 counties, right? Those are county employees that do that work. And so there will be local decisions that are made. But then, you know, take a sidestep here, right? You've got the regulatory environment that states operate with regard to their health providers, right? And, you know, that's another shared responsibility space, right? When we go into a hospital and do regulatory oversight, we have state laws we're enforcing. We have federal laws of participations for the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. Centers for Medicaid and Medicare contracts with us, the state, to be their person on the ground to do that work. Those laws are often in conflict, right? And so figuring out how to navigate which one is which, like state law may have a penalty of $10 and CMS may say you shut down, right?
Right.
And so, you know, and that can make it very hard. And that's why I totally understand where people experience their government and they're like, why is this so hard? Mm-hmm. And like, and when you take like an underpaid public employee that is not supported and is overworked, it can be very hard for them to have feel like they have any agency in their role. Sure. And sometimes they can represent something that is really complicated. And that's something I think we have to do better. How do these things stack up more elegantly? And how do lawmakers try to help us clarify these things so that way it can be easier to implement, easier to deliver, so that we can have the net effect, which is the public can get the services that they need and things can make sense.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I really appreciate all of the things you shared with our audience today. You know, Cody, what's next for you? Like, share with our audience what's happening next. What are you looking out for? You know, what's next for you?
Well, you know, right now I am very focused on the exact questions that you asked me, which is how can I help, you know, the kind of policy sphere and my friends that are still in state government roles all across the country think about implementation of these new requirements in a way that continues to serve people, continues to meet our goals of helping support the health and well-being of the public. But, you know, bigger picture, you know, I still ground myself as a kid that grew up in North Carolina uninsured. And I remember how difficult it was for my mother navigating a health system that was very confusing and very fragmented. And, you know, I fast forward over the last 40 years and I think about all the gains we have made in coverage, cancer cure rates, in access, the trillions of dollars we pumped into the system. And, you know, if I were to think about my mother of today, in a similar situation, or a mother in my mother's situation today, I think the healthcare system is even more complicated, even more expensive. Right? Fast forward with all the vertical integration, all the competition, all the friction that we've pushed on people. And I think it demands everybody in health policy and everybody in health implementation to really continue to think harder about how do we make this better? Because we've made progress, but we've not made it perfect. And we have a lot more work to do. And that's where I'm spending my time.
That's great. Thank you so much.